Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Michael McLennan. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Greg Spottiswoode, creator and showrunner of the new global TV drama Remedy. Now in its first season, the series burst onto the scene with a fresh take on character-driven medical dramas. Remedy goes beyond the operating room and ER to chronicle the fascinating upstairs-downstairs politics within a hospital and one amazing family in particular. Remedy is Greg's second series for Shaw Media. How has he created shows that catch the eye of broadcasters and the attention of audiences? I sat down with my old friend, along with a jam-packed theater of fans and fellow writers, for an exclusive behind-the-scenes exploration into the heart of a series and what makes it tick. This is the latest installation of Writers Talking TV, which is brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. And this evening, I have the pleasure of... My name is Michael McLennan. And this evening, I have the pleasure of speaking with Greg Spottiswoode, who's the creator and showrunner of the new global hit series, Remedy. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you.
Most recently, Greg served as the co-creator, showrunner, and executive producer of King, which was also a successful series for Shaw Media on Showcase. It ran for two seasons and was nominated for a Canadian Screen Award for Best Dramatic Series in 2013. Previously, Spottiswoode wrote and co-produced the drama Shattered, that starred Callum Keith Rennie. In 2009, Greg took home the Canadian Screenwriting Award for his work on CBC Radio's universally renowned drama Afghanida. His 2006 screenplay for North of Hope was also lauded by the Canadian Screenwriting Awards when it received a nomination for Best Movie of the Week or Miniseries. Greg served as writer for Tripping the Wire, which went on to win both a Hugo Award and a Gemini Award for Best TV Movie. Some people don't realize this, Greg's also an accomplished director, and previously to his career as a writer, he was a highly regarded actor. He's the recipient of an Emmy Award and a Gemini nomination for his performance in Looking for Miracles, and he had lead roles in over 20 film and television productions. Please welcome Greg Spottiswoode. And can I just say it's a pleasure to sit with you, Greg. Greg and I are old friends, so hopefully we'll try and retain a degree of professionalism.
Decorum.
Here. Yes.
We should have gotten drunk before.
You mean you didn't?
I didn't. But I got my vodkas.
Okay, that's what that is. Oh, that's so nice of them. So, Greg, so the basic structure of the evening, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, is we're going to talk a little bit about the series in overview. Then we're going to screen an episode, and this evening it's going to be the first episode of the series. And then we're going to continue with a bit more of a substantial conversation after that, and then open it up to questions. So, Greg, firstly, can you talk a bit about the history of the show and how it came to be, basically? What was the genesis of the series?
It actually had a very fast genesis. We did two seasons of King with Shaw. When I say we, I mean Bernie Zuckerman and I. This Remedy is the third series that we've worked on together. The first one we did a pilot for CBC that didn't get picked up, and then we did King and now Remedy. So we went out to lunch with some of the folks from Shaw, Tara, who's here, and Susan, who's our production executive, and we were just basically doing a sort of post-mortem on King. We were all disappointed that we didn't get a third season, but we all felt it was a successful collaboration. And so we asked them, Bernie and I asked them, what else are you guys looking for? What are you interested in? And they said, well, you know, if you came up with a hospital show, we'd have a look at it. So I went, well, geez, I've never thought about writing a hospital show. Okay, I'm going to go make a hospital show. So I went away for a few weeks and turned it over in my mind. And thought about my sister-in-law works in a hospital part-time, putting herself through school, and she works as a PSA, and
which is
personal service assistant. Is that right, Carrie? Yeah. I should know that. We have them in our show. I just call them PSAs. Anyway, she had told a couple of stories about stuff that had happened to her, and I thought, this is a world that we haven't explored. Obviously, hospital dramas are great, renowned, you know, genre, and I like working in genre. I like having rules set. I had just done a cop show. The idea of working within those strictures was really interesting to me, and I think there's a lot more flexibility in them, funnily enough, than if you have a total blank slate. But I thought, oh, this would be cool to see, you know, basically an upstairs, downstairs kind of view. We'll have, you know, sucking chest wounds coming in through the ER, but we'll maybe see them from a slightly different perspective. So I went back and talked to Bernie about that. Bernie thought that was a great idea, and Bernie and I are all both interested in family, and we were talking about family.
So what happened was that the folks at Shaw, they were like, we're interested in the arena of a hospital drama. Yes. And then you went away and you thought about it.
Yeah.
And this is where became interesting and you felt was fresh, was the sort of upstairs, downstairs.
Yeah, and it was my interest too, right. You know, and family is always my interest. You know, King had a family at the heart of it, And so we decided to put a family in the hospital and have that family represent or be involved in all the stratas of the hospital. So management, the chief of staff and a doctor, Rico Colatoni. Then we had a surgeon and a nurse and then a porter, somebody who works downstairs, and what we used to call an orderly. So we came back to Shaw with that. And I remember one of the first things I said in the pitch was no one saves a life alone, and that doctors are heroes, but they're not the only ones who are heroic in a hospital. And that seemed to grab their attention. So they said, okay, why don't you go away and write a pilot? So I did. I think I wrote it fairly fast. I can't remember, Tara. It was a very fast turnaround. Then they said they wanted to do it. And so I think it was 10 months from the day that I delivered the pilot to the first day of principal photography. So it was a really fast turnaround, which was just amazing, the support from them. And it was challenging, but it was great. If I talk too much, you can just stop.
No, please keep talking. No, that's great. And one of the things that I've gone through this experience as well, but one of the things that's interesting is that the show was not piloted, which means it didn't, you know, go through the process of writing one episode, which was then cast and filmed and posted and shown around the corridors of Shaw Media. And then before a decision was made, it was a decision to order a straight-to-series show. And, you know, what was that about for you guys? I mean, do you think that was part of the relationship that you had with Shaw, the track record? Did you feel a greater sense of pressure to know that you were delivering on a full season rather than just 1 hour?
Well, we did King that way too, so I don't know any other way. I mean, Bernie and I made a pilot for CBC, so we'd done it. I didn't feel more pressure. No, I actually like it. I mean, I think it was a great vote of confidence. I mean, a remarkable vote of confidence on Shaw's part in terms of King. Because I had never run a show before. Mm. We had worked together on Shattered. But I also had Bernie Zuckerman, right? I mean, for those of you who don't know Bernie, Bernie is he's in Savannah right now. But he's a legend, in my mind anyway. He's been in the business for 40 years, and he's made a lot of great Canadian television. He really believes in Canadian television. So when you have Bernie beside you, that inspires a lot of confidence in a broadcaster. He's delivered a lot of television. He's delivered it on time, on budget, and he knows how to work with a broadcaster. So, and he showed faith in me.
These are like most recently, This Is Wonderland.
This Is Wonderland was the only other series he had done. He had done the big CBC miniseries of the 90s, like Dieppe. A lot of big movies. The Quintuplets, I think, was his. And before that, he was the commissioning producer for the Journal, a documentary producer. So he inspires a lot of confidence. So I think, you know, the fact that I had worked with Shaw a little bit before on Shattered and that I had Bernie sitting beside me saying he believes that I could do it was a big vote of confidence. So I think we built up a relationship. I mean, you'd have to ask them, but we built up a relationship over the course of King and trust, you know, and I think that's a big thing with a broadcaster is you are making the same show, and you keep your word. You say, this is what we're going to do, and you're open, and you have a great dialogue. And so I think that probably helped them pull the trigger fast. They knew we could make a television show. They knew we could make it fast, and we knew they believed in that we would deliver the show that we talked about in the room. And I think we've done that.
And when you think about, you know, because it's an ensemble drama, you think about how that really could have worked in the Canadian system as a pilot, where you would have had to option quite a large number of people, and in your case, some top tier actors, what essentially amounts to a year's option, and then trying to get the right people who would be willing to do that, it becomes really a challenge.
So I think it would have been impossible with that cast. I mean, we have, I think, one of the most remarkable casts, not just in Canada, but in North America. I think we have, some of them are here tonight, and it's a really stunning group of people, and they're all in demand. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's, you know, Rico, who you know, very specifically chose this project after Flashpoint, he was very much in demand, and the Sarahs and Dylan Casey, you know, these are tough actors to get. And so I don't think it would have been possible if we had just done a pilot deal with those folks.
Yeah, I can see that. So let's talk a bit about casting then. So we may discuss this a bit later too, Greg, but, you know, I'm interested in how your work as an actor informs your work as a writer and a showrunner. But in terms of casting, when you were creating the show, did you have ideas for people in mind, and Were you writing for specific actors?
No, I mean, sometimes I write with specific actors in my head, but I don't intend to cast them necessarily.
Sort of the ideal, just to have
But I know a lot of actors, so when it comes to casting, I drive the casting people crazy sometimes, because I start saying, well, we need to see these people. And a lot of the people that I know, because a lot of my work as an actor was on stage, are theater actors. And often they don't have a lot of film and television experience, not because they're not good at it, but because they're usually booked in the theater. They're either at one of the festivals, or they're in one of the major regionals, or they're making their own work. But I kind of try and reach out and get... I think that's the really... underused resource, particularly in Toronto, stage actors.
So you were saying to the casting people, this is a great list, and let me add to 12
Yeah, and have you been to Shaw lately, or have you been to Stratford, because there's that person. And we you know, our shooting schedule, we shoot in the winter, which is hard, but it's great because both the big festivals are dark, so there's this unbelievably rich and deep pool of talent that's kind of hanging around.
Well, I think it's one of the things that really distinguishes the show, especially in your guest stars, is the number of strong theater actors that you have in for just, you know, one episode arcs, but it really melded with the strong series regulars you have, it really elevates the
material. And I think it's great that Bernie and the directors and the broadcasters all, sometimes they're taking a flyer on these actors. They don't have a lot of film and television experience, but they've got a resume as long as your arm. And so sometimes it takes me or, you know, the casting people just say, yeah, let's take a chance. It's, I don't think of it as taking a chance on them. I think it's these are great actors, and this is just, they just don't have a lot of time to play in this pool.
And were there ever cases where people were nervous that they were going to be overly theatrical, or that the directors needed to kind of...
They are overly theatrical sometimes, but I mean,
well, some of what they're being asked to do is
I mean, God, it's a melodrama sometimes. People screaming down the ER, they better be big. I mean, I, as an actor, it always amazed me when people talk about film and television, about getting smaller, and then you look at the great film and television performances, and they're huge, right? I mean, they're controlled for the camera and they're selected, but you know. Walter White is a big character. You know, Jack Nicholson, one of the great screen actors, you know, in world cinema, is huge. Have you seen him in Witches of Eastwick? Okay, maybe that's the wrong choice. That might have been the wrong one.
So tell us a bit about how you came to the series regulars that we're going to see on the screen tonight. Was an easy process? You say, I mean, overall, it doesn't sound like you had much time to put it together. Where did you find your people? Was it an easy experience, or did you?
Well, John Buchan and Jason Knight were the casting agents, and they we hadn't worked together before, but I knew Jason because he used to be an actor.
Yes.
And Shaw had worked with them.
Everybody pretty much used to be an actor.
Everybody used to be an actor.
You used to be an actor. Or a stage manager. That's you true. Were either one or the other. I was an actor.
You were an actor.
Yeah. But you started as the actor or the stage manager. That's kind of how it worked.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
And I don't know. You could probably do like a personality wheel or something about that. And then there's like the 17 jocks that figured out their way later.
It's true.
You know, like they saw the error of their ways.
Yeah, they broke their femur in a football right? game in third year and went, hey, drama. Now they're on Broadway.
That's right, yeah.
So... We sat down with Shaw and Jason and John and I think that, you know, I think the right word is strategized. I think we really, you know, took a strategic approach. We said, okay, who are our key roles? Obviously, the four people in the family. We were looking for people who had some. I don't like the phrase TVQ because I don't even know what it means, but some profile. Mm-hmm. So that shortened the list a little bit, and then you know we went after some very specific people. I mean, I think all of them. There was no gimmies, you know, except for Rico. I think.
What do you mean by gimmies?
Well, just sort of. You know, saying, would you do this? Would you, do, you know, like
I see.
Sarah Canning and Sarah Allen auditioned.
Yeah.
Multiple times. The competition was very stiff for those two roles. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in our hearts, I think we had a, it was, I'm in the audition, so I talk a lot to the actors. So it's partly I'm pitching to them because they all have choices. I mean, Sarah Allen was in what, like two other television series this year? Sarah Canning's always in demand, obviously. Rico, we took out to dinner. I took him out to dinner, and
that did the trick.
Yeah. Well, it was a long chat.
Where did you take him?
Deluxe on Ossington. Very nice steak frites. And he said no. He said no at that night. He was waiting to hear about something else, and we hung in there. And he really did want to do the show. He was.
So what was that conversation about? He'd obviously read the material. He knew what the role was, and what was he sussing out there? Do you think?
I think one of the things I talked about was that I'm an actor, so it's a show that's friendly to actors, or at least I like to believe that. Mm-hmm. I listen to them, and we write for them, and so I think that. It appealed to him, I think, to work with a showrunner who understood or claimed to understood acting. I talked to him about the show, about tone. Mm-hmm. One of the things I like about the show, one of the things that's challenging about making the show is the tone, the variety of tone. And I think that he had come off of, you know, Flashpoint, which is very, you know, obviously its success is without question, but... I think he was using a narrower band of what he's capable of as an actor. I mean, he came from sitcoms, you know, and you
wouldn't
know.
Yeah, I would think it would be really appealing to him because there's this incredible, there is a kind of Flashpointian urgency and stakes at times, but there's also a lighter tone and there's a kind of a playful
and sometimes whimsy, you know, like he brings a kind of whimsy to the role, which is really interesting. And I think that really, he wanted to do more comedy, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, the show is never outright comedy, but he liked that. And so I think
he was trying to make sure he understood the tone that absolutely. What he was reading was what you were saying.
Yeah. And, you know, when you meet with people like Rico, it's like meeting with any of your collaborators. You're making a promise, mm-hmm. you know, you're mm-hmm. saying, this is what I believe the show is about. This is where I think it's going. And I think the other thing is I'm very honest about what I don't know about the show. When I talk to a broadcaster, when I talk to an actor, when I talk to a director or writer, I'm pretty honest about saying, listen, this is what I figured out, and this is what I haven't. And I remember saying to Rico, you know, okay, so most of the time, let's hope that we get you in the end zone. Like, you know, you just be there, and we'll throw the ball, and... I'm not really a football guy, but I'm talking about it like I am. And then sometimes I
not one of the 17 jocks.
Not one of the 17 jocks. And sometimes, you know, it's episodic television. Sometimes we're going to fall short of the mark, you know, whether it's a scene or a storyline that maybe we're not quite there yet. And I said, we're going to be at the 20-yard line, and you're going to have to get it in. We'll give you the ball, but you're going to have to go, okay, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm. And I think that appealed to him, like the candor of that. Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't promising that we've had it all figured out, because I don't know why you, I mean, you've made more television shows than I am. Nobody I know has figured it out in the first season. I mean,
well, I think that's great that you can feel safe enough to talk about it in terms of what you didn't, you know, that this is what we're aiming for. You want to make sure that everybody, the key players are all sort of seeing the same show, but there's a lot to be tested, really.
Yeah, first seasons are trial and error. They really are, you know, and I don't know. There are experiments in this season of Remedy. There are structural experiments in the second half of the season. We try some different sort of storytelling devices, and there are tonal experiments. So that's what I think is really cool about making a serial.
You talked about it earlier this evening about how you're drawn to genre and that you like the kind of found principles of a strong genre. You just did a police procedural, and now this is a hospital show. Both very much with your kind of unique mark, and I wouldn't call them either of them sort of a straight ahead procedurals. When you were thinking about, just let's go back a bit then, in those sort of early mulling weeks when you were thinking about what kind of show would be your hospital drama, did you have series that you were inspired by? And conversely, did you have series that you kind of wanted to, with all respect to the series, that you just felt like you wanted to step away from?
Not so much step away from, but I did have series that I was inspired by. I remember saying in that pitch to the broadcaster that Saving Hope's a good show, respect. You know, House, amazing show, respect. Grey's, absolutely. Like, we should all be so lucky. That's, you know, great. Sure. But let's skip over those, go back to the first two seasons of ER. Mm-hmm. Let's touch down there, because that, like, rewatch the first seasons of ER. They're amazing. Change the height of the waistline and the pant and give people cell phones, and it would be a hit all over again. But I wanted to go farther back to St. Elsewhere, which is, you know, in terms of format, or I guess pacing, is sort of pre-Hill Street Blues, so it doesn't have the pace that we're used to, but it's a whole world. It really, it's very interesting storytelling, and so I looked at that, and that was one of the things I remember feeling like it was a risk in the pitch. I remember thinking, oh my God,
say those words.
Yeah, well, it's like a 30-year-old television show. Who references a 30-year-old television show?
Just like I Love Lucy.
It's just going to be like Beretta.
Talk about, like, what were some of the touchstones for St. Elsewhere? Because I remember you talked about that with me before.
Yeah.
And what, like, if you had to say sort of three things that St. Elsewhere, the qualities of that show that you wanted to emulate, and that you didn't feel were in a fairly it's an arena. Hospital shows are out there, so you're looking to distinguish yourself. So how was that a good touchstone for you?
I think one of the things is just something that I'm drawn to, which is a mixture of tone. Mm-hmm. You know, in an episode of that show, you can have a tragic storyline and a comic storyline, and they live side by side.
Right.
So I think, you know, that I really liked. It had a soap opera quality to it, but it was soap opera in the sense that these relationships were evolving and developing, and on a romantic level, but also on a psychological and deeper emotional level, and I thought that was really appealing. I love the cross-section of the hospital. I mean, you've got doctors, you've got it's a very much a doctor show, but I mean, at one point, Howie Mandel is like having an affair with the person who works in the morgue, like it's who is so weird if you see it, and so I just like that. I like the whole cross section of it. I thought that was really interesting.
And can you say more about pacing? Because I honestly can't remember what how it was uniquely paced. And
well, St. Elsewhere wasn't. It was of its time. It was slower, right? Like, I mean, you know, when ER came along, they just ramped it all up. I think there's an interview with Tom Fontana on, if you guys don't know, there's an Academy website in the States with these archived interviews that are like 2 to 4 hours long with people who made television. So
that's how long we're going to go.
Yeah.
Okay. If it's two, we're going to go 5 hours.
So Tom Fontana talked about how they just looked at St. Elsewhere and sped it up. And I think Steven Spielberg said that he just basically wanted to shoot a hospital drama as an action movie. And you can see it, right? The Steadicam, Mimi Leader directed the pilot. And so everything's changed after that.
So did you feel like you wanted to sort of take it down a notch?
No, I love pace.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is a thrillingly paced series.
I love pace. In fact, yeah. I think one of the criticisms that's most regularly leveled at our work is that it's, you know, sometimes it goes too fast. Hmm. But I like it. I trust the audience can follow. I think life moves at a pretty fast pace.
Yeah,
now.
I mean, just to speak of the episode we're going to watch, I think the first 10 minutes of this are just like absolutely thrillingly paced. I mean, there's not a moment you can take a breath, and yet I think you can always follow what's going on.
Well, Kelly Macon really understood the pace of the script, and I think Kelly really deserves some credit for that too,
right,
because he picked it up off the script.
Kelly was the director.
He directed the pilot,
and we're going to talk. We'll talk about Kelly a bit more afterwards.
Sure.
But so for you, he really understood what you were.
He embraced it. You know, he really embraced it, and that was really gratifying. And he pushed me too. You know, but we can talk about that later.
Cool. Okay. I just want to make sure that I think what I'll do now is we can maybe get it all teed up to watch. So, I wanted to talk a bit more about your pilot writing process, Greg. It's so hard to figure out where to drop the needle on a show. And it's that, you know, critical first episode, which whether it's going to be the filmed or not, you know it's being judged by many people to figure out does this show have the ingredients and the stamina to be a long-running successful series for us. What was your process of figuring out what are the stories that we're going to watch here? Did they come simply? Was there a lot of back and forth with the network? Like, did you pitch out your basic plot lines before you wrote the first episode?
I mean, I like origin pilots. You know, there are, I guess broadly speaking, there are two kinds of pilots. They're pilots that represent what every episode will be structurally and format wise and then there are origin
like
pilots,
Law and Order or something
and then there are origin pilots, which says this is how they ended up here, or this is how this person ended up here. So both King and Remedy are origin pilots, but still have what I wanted them to have was still have a core standalone genre element, and I knew that I wanted to do that, and I knew that I wanted to introduce the family in a way that that the audience started putting the relationships together. Like most, I don't even know if this is true, but I told myself this, that that most shows start with the family together at the beginning. I told them, this is a little game I played. I said, so let's not put the family together until the last scene.
Yeah.
So people had to sort of figure out what the relationship, so there was some pleasure in sort of going, oh my God, they're sisters.
Right.
So that was sort of the organizing principle of the pilot, and I think it was a bit of a risk. It didn't feel like it at the time, but subsequently I've come to think of it as like, because you're asking the audience to hang on in the first episode, and that we will explain how these people are connected.
But it's like you don't lean too heavily on your premise that they're a family from the get-go. Like each character stands on his or her own. They have their own stories, and then it only enriches things when you start to realize the dynamics are family dynamics.
That's nice of you to say. That's what we wanted to do, you know, I think. And it was So yeah, thanks.
But can you talk about, it's just, and then we'll get and watch it. But I'm always curious about how you we figure out what are the first stories. Like, how did you figure out, you must have had an array of medical stories, for example, that, you're going to, and we'll talk about how you deal with that amazing challenge after. But how did you decide this is the right story, these are the right medical stories for the pilot, they balance each other accordingly, this is where the characters should be when we first meet them. How did you know what to do?
I tend to be fairly intuitive about the scripts that I write. I have this big black book and I don't have any lines on it. I don't like books with lines on
them. I've seen that book.
And I color. So I put everything kind of on, it's almost like a diagram or something. And then I'll put an image or I'll put an idea on these blank pages. And then after I've done that, I start drawing connections between them. I start seeing connections, but I don't force that a little bit. It drives the writing room crazy, I think. I don't use cards at first when I'm working on my own. It's too linear. Mm-hmm. It gives me anxiety. but eventually we do. And so, but I did know two things. I knew that I wanted to do the needle stick storyline that's in the pilot because it happened. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interesting truths in it. And
it sets up a very, important.
So that was that anchored me and was part of my original pitch. I think when I pitched the series before I'd written the pilot, I said this happens. This
is well, and it's a great encapsulation of your themes of the sort of upstairs downstairs, where certain people make errors and certain people pay those
power.
Prices, right?
And the other was the family thing, and that actually just started with the image, which, I don't know how many, I'm assuming you've all seen some of the show, otherwise you'd be here, wouldn't be here, but the machete, which when I was working on a cop show, I heard a story about a bar fight like that and somebody ending up with a machete. So that image was always really, really strong, and it seemed like kind of weird and big, like a machete, what, really? But I just decided that I was going to commit to it. I was just going to trust it. I had no good reason to trust it. And funnily enough, that's not the that's not the actual medical case of the week, mm-hmm. Which is, I think, what I originally thought it would be, but then it became this other thing.
So you had a few sort of key images that had kind of stuck with you and you felt had a sort of a sufficiently kind of compelling elements to them.
Yeah, and then I took those, and then I went out and did research. Then I went out and met doctors and porters and PSAs and informed those. So the fecal transplant thing was something that had just happened to somebody that I had talked to and was a very new treatment at the time I was talking to him. It's actually much more common now. So that gave me lots of fuel, But yeah, I tend to, for better or for worse, kind of go with a gut image and try and make sense of it in the context of the show. And sometimes I can and sometimes I can't, but I prefer working that way.
So it was about finding a few of these and then figuring out which characters would be connected to these and shading in the interrelationships.
It sounds very twee, but it's a bit like archaeology. I kind of feel like I find a fragment of a story, and then there's another fragment of a story over there, and I start trying to find out what the relationships between those fragments are, and all of a sudden they start fitting together, or I make them fit together.
And then make it look effortless and inevitable.
and then, you bring structural rigor to it and, you kill your babies. There's a great scene,
that's in my head.
That we didn't shoot because the script was too long. My scripts are always too long. Where Alan there's in one of the hospitals I visited, the doctors shower in an area where they store mannequins. So there are sort of half naked mannequins dressed as nurses and things like in this shower. I saw it, and they come in, they shower amongst these mannequins. It's like the strangest thing. There's like Night out of the Evil Dead or something. but that's the, it's, and I wrote it into the pilot, and we all loved it, but it ended up on the floor because we couldn't fit it.
Couldn't get that mannequin in yet. That's second season, man.
That's second season. Spoiler. Series. Season premiere.
Is there anything you want to say to help tee up what we're going to see, Greg?
I don't think so. I do just want to say, I mean, there are a bunch of people here. There's some actors who are in the show that are here, and some of the writers. And, you know, the first day of the show, first table read, and the crew was there. A lot of the crew was there. I said that, you know, that one of the taglines for the show is no one saves a life alone, but I don't think anybody makes a TV show alone. And I'm very flattered, you know, to be sitting here right now, but I think you know as well as anybody that television shows are made by teams. And if they have any success, it's because that team listened to each other and worked together and worked through conflict and brought them, especially a show like this, which, you know, I'd like to believe has great heart. They bring themselves to it. They bring emotional risk to the work, whether they're writers or they're actors. And so I guess it's not really setting up the pilot, but it is setting up the series because it was made by a group of people and not by one person. And a lot of collaborators from broadcasters on down. We talk a lot. And so I'm just very grateful for that.
Fantastic. Wow. Well, and I just add that I think it has a lot to say about the quality of your leadership, that people feel they can bring their best game, whether it's as a key creative or an actor or a writer, you know, it's all starts with the showrunner. We'll talk about that again after. I think we're going to watch this, baby.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Okay, so it's about 45 minutes long. There may be a few brief dark spots, which is where you can imagine soap ads. And otherwise, we'll just play it through. Thanks.
Oh.
So, what was that like for you to watch?
Oh God! You just see the things you want to change, really. You just see all the stuff, you know, that you want to tighten, or performance things, or things that you couldn't fix that you.
Really, give me one thing. What would you change?
I'd tighten some of the scenes up.
You tighten the scenes up. It feels impeccably paced. I don't know where.
Well, we worked really hard on it, I guess. You know, I don't want to. You know, it's just the anybody who's. All of us who've made things, we see them. I'm proud of the show. It's not like I'm not proud of it. I think everybody did a great job, and I know I've been going on about actors, but we have like the best cast.
Yeah.
Like really, like we didn't stand a chance unless we had people with real chops. And so that's I think the biggest thing when I've seen, because I've seen it a few times now, in a couple times in front of an audience, and that's the thing that I'm constantly in awe of.
Well, and you even, I mean, it's even the smallest roles all soar. You know, you have incredible ability up there in every role.
We're very lucky. I mean, there are actors like Deborah Hay, for example, who plays
the mother
of Kai. She is one of the leading classical actresses in North America. She plays leads, and you know we got her for like three scenes. You know, like it's just amazing, and I we love casting that way. You know, if we're lucky enough to get somebody who's willing to do that, it just enriches the show.
For me, watching them as another time, I was just struck by how masterfully woven everything is, like where you don't have scenes so much as small beats or episodes within a sequence of events, that it's a very fluid understanding of what, you know, it can be just a two-line exchange that's in the past of somewhere something else is happening. And I was wondering, like, how do you break an episode where you're working within this sort of weaving tapestry as opposed to a sort of a sense of a set of themes or a set of scenes?
It's really hard, to be honest. I write that way naturally. I don't know how many people are. I mean, Sandra's here. She was in the writer's room. John, you guys in Nusri, you guys could probably talk better about this. But I think we talk a lot about flow. We talk, you know, we call it jazz, you know, in the room. Like what's, we'll, after the writers pitch their stories and put the cards up, you know, we at a certain point we end up sort of blowing it apart, moving stuff around and kind of going, what's the flow? What's the... And I've been thinking a lot about it because there are a couple of there's a few episodes that are a little bit more traditionally structured, mm-hmm. and we did that on purpose. We thought, okay, well, let's see. But I've been thinking a lot about it as I have my fingers crossed for a second season. And I think that one of the things that I was talking to somebody about this today, that one of the things I love about the show is connectivity. I love the sense that all of these people. Who are living disparate lives are somehow connected. But I think the downside of that, to be honest, is that the hospital can feel small. It can feel like a small world if the family's all working on the same case or if they're all... So finding a balance between that sense of connectivity, the sense that everybody's fates are somehow intertwined, either in the episode or across the season or beyond, and the family sense, the family within the family of the hospital, all of that, and still making it feel like a big city hospital and that it's, you know, it's not, you know, in Beausejour or something.
Right. Well, and it's at least in its early episodes, it's very, very much about the hospital. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, aside from a few exteriors, you're really committed to the world of your show.
Well, and that's sort of, that was sort of by accident because we were going to go 2 days out and, you know, I mean, you can see in the pilot, I mean, you know, talk about like we were going to go home with Griffin and Dad.
Right. And they lived together.
It was, we teed it up. And I wrote the second episode and it started with Griffin waking up in Dad's house. And a number of events conspired against it, frankly. One was we wanted a big city feel, so we went to Hamilton and found a couple of hospitals that we could shoot at on Sundays and to open up the show.
They didn't have sick people on Sundays?
Well, once the Jerevansky cancer... yeah, we kicked them out.
Right.
Film.
It's a whole new crop.
Important.
Every Monday, it's a whole new crop of patients.
I know you have cancer, but could you...
You have 6 weeks to die. 6 weeks to live. 6 days to live.
Rolling. So the Jerevansky Cancer Center in Hamilton,
uh-huh.
and Shadok, we used for some of the downstairs because our set wasn't quite finished being built because we were... You know, this happened so fast. So that burned my days out as
uh-huh.
a showrunner. And so there was a, we had to think of a different plan.
Well, it gave the hospital in, it's that thing where if you have a couple scenes that aren't a set, you start to feel like everything isn't a set.
Absolutely.
Right? And so I think, I mean, if I may say, I think that wasn't a bad
it was
choice,
the right decision
really,
it
you
was
have those open glassy you know there's a few
it
scenes
was it
where
was absolutely the right decision
and, yeah.
But it was one of those things where there was a hiccup, you know,
right.
as a creator you kind of go oh
so that forced you to be a bit limber then in how you thought you would tell the story, and it really became about okay, this in every sense is a hospital drama
and it becomes more I hope it doesn't feel like a play, but you have to think about it. You're a playwright. I've never been a playwright, but you have to think about it a little bit more that way, a little bit more contained.
And now that you have what is, by all accounts, I've talked to some of the actors, and they say it feels like walking onto a hospital set, like you could actually, you know, perform operations. And
Oleg,
at the end of it, you should, you know, donate.
The design team did
an
amazing job. Oleg and the props and the set deck guys, a lot of the equipment is like the real stuff.
Yeah.
So
now that you know, now you sort of know, okay, these are the, barring your days out, these are kind of the pieces of the tools in your toolbox, the colors of your crayon set or whatever. Do you then start to think about variety of worlds within the hospital setting, like to make sure that if you're going to have, you're not going to have three OR storylines in the same episode.
Yeah,
we need to keep the variety.
We do. I mean, we have the everything's a double edge, right? So on one hand, unlike ER, this isn't an ER show. Mm-hmm. So we're not all in one place, and that's great. It has the benefit of, you know, a diverse environment and diverse characters. So we're in ICU, ER, OR, downstairs, and in wardrooms. That's sort of our broad thing. So it's great. We get to expand. It feels bigger. But at the same time, when talking about connectivity, you're like, okay, how do I connect Alan to what's right. happening if in ER? Whereas right. you look at something like ER or House or whatever, it's a very focused, concentrated physical environment that they're all in. And so the idea of pass-bys and people connecting and catching up on a personal story while a procedural story moves on, those shows have their challenges, but, you know, we're spread out over a place the size of St. Mike's.
Right.
In our heads,
right.
So yeah, we thought about opening the show and not being we never have a full on OR show or a full on ICU show. There's usually the character. The season is built. The first half of the season is built to focus on a member of the family in the first half of the season. So it's not democratic. It's not.
You mean that each episode.
Yeah,
so
first episode is family, but obviously a focus on Griffin. Second episode is Griffin and Mel. Third episode is Sandy. Mm-hmm. Fourth episode is Alan. Mm-hmm. And fifth episode is a little bit more focused on the downstairs. So we bring Bruno, mm-hmm. Diego forward. And then we get more into a pattern. But I, rather than try and service all of those characters evenly in the first half of the season, we chose to kind of say, okay, let's give Sandy the water to carry in this and give people a good chance to get to know her.
Right. So you touched on this a couple minutes ago when you talked about the writing room beating out stories in that. So let's talk about the writer's room now.
Okay.
So how did you go about deciding who to put in your writer's room, first of all? And what do you look for when you're looking, when you're considering writers?
Oh, God. I don't know yet. it's only my second show. I think a lot about it. We all do. It's hard. Where I've landed initially, and this is partly something that David Barlow, who was my co-executive producer on King, he and I talked about it a lot, and he gave me this interview with Josh Whedon around the time of Buffy, and they were asking about Buffy in the writer's room, and he said he really wasn't happy until the fifth season. And I may be misremembering the content of this, and David, you can tell me if I'm misremembering it. But the what I took from it anyway is he said, you like first season, you go, it's a baseball team. I'm gonna get it. There's a person who's good on dialogue, and there's a good person who's good on procedure, and that person's fantastic on structure. I'm gonna put them together, and it's like a super team. And for some reason, that doesn't work out, or like it doesn't quite fire on all cylinders as much as you want, or whatever. And so you try and do that again and again. And where he landed was two things. Are they a good writer? And do I like them? Because everybody is going to fall. When you're under the pressure of making television on our schedules with very little lead time, as we've had on this show and I had on King, scripts are going to come in not quite right. Not ready, or there's going to be a production crisis, and you're going to have to rewrite overnight, or an actor's going to come in, and they're going to have very thoughtful, challenging questions for you, and you're going to have to do it. And so, at a certain point, you're going to be running on adrenaline. There's going to be some sort of crisis, and you have to at that point. Like, I drop the ball, they drop the ball. We all, you know, we have to pick. And liking each other actually helps in that environment. You know, you go, oh, I like you, I'll help you. as opposed to, you're good in plot, but I, you know, I don't want to have dinner with you. But you're good in plot.
And I don't want to spend the next 12 hours straight with you.
Really, you are. You're in. You know, in those times, you're in a room in the middle part of the season, you know, for, you know, 10, 12 hours. I'm writing the finale. Oh my God, John Callahan and I were there basically 24 hours at one point. Like, we were really up against it, and it's like 4 o'clock, and I look out my office, and there's John, hanging in there, and there's a real intangible in that, and because I've only been a showrunner, you know, this is my second show. I actually don't know all the writers and meet as many as I can. So it's trial and error.
And just because there's a number of writers here.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I have a feeling. How do you gauge that? Because I'm imagining also, I mean, I know for a fact that you didn't just turn around and write and hire just writers that you knew. That
no,
you were
no,
interested
I didn't.
Not at all. Finding, you know, to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
People that you thought would be the right fit, that strange alchemy of a writer's room. And so when you were interviewing people and meeting with them or talking to them on the phone or reading their material, what were the things that would turn your head? And let's split that into two.
Yeah,
one
please.
Is the one-on-one, what like when you were actually meeting people.
Yeah.
And the other is the material. What kind of material did you like to read? And what were the things that made you go, okay, this is somebody worth considering strongly?
Well, the easier one in terms of material is it's nice to see a spec script of an existing show because you just see if they play by the rules, right? Whatever the rules of that show are.
And this would be more for writers who maybe don't have a series of credits
to
their name?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Or even if they do, you know, like, you know, sometimes younger writers will often make the mistake of, this is a very special episode of The Good Wife.
Right, that bears no resemblance.
That bears no resemblance. I just thought it would be really interesting to send them camping.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, that's a really good episode of some other show.
Or to kill off one of their young male hot lead. But, oh, wait a second.
Never mind. And the other one is in original material. Somebody was asking me today about like whether I read features, and you know, okay, like what do you get out of reading a feature? And I said I get a scene structure. Mm. Obviously, feature structure is very different. So, you know, whether they're thinking about structure, you can tell. But I get whether they can build a scene or they can build a sequence, because you know, essentially, an act of television is a sequence. It's a cinematic sequence. So if they can start building that, so I personally don't so much look on the back row, but I go, okay, well, they know how to construct that. They know how to paste that on the page. In person, when I talk to them...
Before we go there, so it's really about analyzing craft in both of those things. It's whether they can be that kind of chameleon force that at least in their chosen scripts, it feels right. It feels like it's of a piece of the voice of the existing show.
I think the other thing I look for is emotional content.
Okay.
Like, am I feeling anything?
Right.
Are they interested in emotion?
And how often, do you find that a rare experience as a reader?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think, I guess.
I do, I agree. I agree.
It's hard to do.
Yeah.
It's hard to engender emotion in 44 minutes. We talk about it in the writer's room a lot. We talked about it a lot this year, the difference between sentimentality and emotion and how to engender emotion through storytelling. And because I'm sentiment averse, right?
Sentiment adverse.
Averse.
Say more about that. We'll get back to the other stuff later.
I guess
down the rabbit hole.
I guess what I mean, and I'm not saying that I achieve it, so I'm not saying like, oh, I believe this and I do it every time. What I mean by sentiment is confirming for the audience what they expected to happen emotionally when they expected it to happen with the people they expected it to happen. So
say more about that.
Well, I'm assuming the third episode, we had we were able to articulate it a little bit by the third episode, when there was this feeling that the audience needed to know more about Griffin, more about where he went. I mean, one of the challenges this season in doing an Origins pilot and doing something where the big inciting incident actually happened 2 years ago was like how do we fill the audience in on some of that backstory without, you know, boring them. And so we...
This is the David Fox
story. The David Fox story, the colonel in episode 3. Griffin has to transport this colonel played by theater legend David Fox. And there was this feeling, anyway, that Griffin needed to talk to his dad, needed to say what he needed to say to his dad. And that happened simultaneously along this storyline that was developing between the colonel and Griffin, which also came quite late in the process. I can't even remember what the C story or B story of that episode was, but I remember walking into the room and saying to a bunch of unhappy writers, I think that story's not right. I don't think it's very good. And you know, there was that silence that you're met with people are going, really? It's been 3 weeks. and you go, yeah, I know, and we ran it down, and we tried, but sorry, and oh, I've got a meeting, so I'll see you guys later. And really, honestly, I had to run for one reason or another. I think I was cutting the pilot. And about 2 hours later, I came back. Adam Barkin was running the room, and I came back, and they had this Colonel story. Like, they hit it out of the park. And then, as that developed, we realized, actually, one of the things that we did in the show, and I don't want it to be a crutch, but it was something that was interesting to talk about this year from a writing perspective, is that people said the right thing to the wrong person. Mm. So Griffin says to the colonel what he should say and what the audience wants him to say to his dad. And if we can earn that moment in a few episodes with a few different characters, maybe we're going to give the audience the emotional scene that they long for, the sort of more cathartic scene or the emotional revelation or whatever, but we can give it to them from slightly an oblique angle. Mm. So that in the... Because I was determined not to have Griffin and Alan make up or talk about what was between them in the third season.
Third episode.
Yeah. I didn't. Third season. I'm hoping we'll.
They might have had a few words.
We're breaking that now.
See if you can.
You might get Alan's apartment set, and then they can say something.
As soon as we get their set.
But that's a really interesting way of looking at it. Is that you sort of know that you need to deliver the emotional experiences for your audience, but you're finding fresh ways of doing it, and that ways that you kind of can't see coming from a mile away.
But, you know, the danger is you become too clever by half, and it's oblique, and the audience doesn't quite get it, or you don't fulfill them. And I think it's an interesting question that I'm asking myself, I'm just being honest about the first season, is should we have gone more direct emotionally sometimes? It was something that Adam Barkin and I talked a lot about, and we talked about the room, but it was a debate, actually, a really healthy debate between Adam and I. His joke was that as soon as I give somebody what they want, I kick them in the shins just before I leave the room.
That, you know, I could sort of hear Adam saying that.
You know, so, you know, like in the last scene with Mel and Griff in the OR, and
This is where he breaks down.
First of all, the music. Robert Carley did the music. I think he's an amazing composer. Yeah. I was right on the bubble about that music. Like, really, I just kind of like, are we pushing it too far? Are we confirming something for the audience that we should just let them understand on their own? I decided to go with it because it was beautiful music. My colleagues liked it and thought it worked. But I think for me, the real reason why is that last image is Mel can't, if you watch it again, she can't actually hug him. Mm-hmm. She's right there, her hand's there, and the last image is, I can't do it. and I, that's our show. That I love, but I, you know, but I am I kept up night occasionally going, should I just give them the hug? Just give them a hug. Adam would walk into my office, just give them the hug. Just give them the hug.
So you have a good, lively debate. It's a place that people can debate.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you'd have to ask the writers. They're here. You can talk to them afterwards. Maybe they'll say a few things too.
So let's take it back to the question. I think gives us a good sense. I mean, if I can sort of headline some of the things you talked about that attract you about scripts, it was a real sense of the craft,
yeah,
a sense of the voice and the ability to be flexible with that voice. And a sense of understanding how to create emotion.
Yeah, and tone, and shifts in tone.
Yeah. So a limberness.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. I think fluid. You know, yeah. Like it, you know, the shows are fluid and emotionally they have to be with this many characters in an ensemble show. It's the first time I've done an ensemble show and found it really challenging. And so you need to be able to switch voices and defend different characters and transition in the writing tonally.
Totally.
You know, you can't expect just music to do it. In fact, what I found increasingly through the season, and we discovered this on King too, I tend to initially overcompose. Like I ask for more music than we need, and then we end up cutting a lot of the cues and I'm increasingly realizing that, like, when we started King, for example, I kept saying to Trevor, the composer, we need a transition here. We need to go from here to here because I think, you know, there's a shift in tone. And poor Trevor or, you know, Rob on this show were just, you know, pulling out everything they could because it's like there's this tragic scene and then it's a comic scene. And how do you want me to bridge that gap?
Right.
And
how does that and that minor chord turn major?
And you try different things. There's different techniques that they have and it's all great. But what I'm increasingly drawn to, if the writing is there, is just to let the writing shift the tone. Mm-hmm. And
so the sound spots where you decide what cues you'll compose and so forth, they became lighter.
Well, I don't think they have. No. I think I'm still learning. I think it's the thing.
Well, that's part of
it. I think it's the thing I love. Process. One of the things I love most about showrunning and is in being involved in a lot of different things in the music. But I think music is the thing I know least about in terms of how it functions, like technically. Mm. I think I know what I like when I hear it, and
it's such a difficult thing to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, like when you're talking to a composer. And it's sort of dancing about architecture.
Yeah,
right? Like
it's
you don't
exactly
really
it.
Know how to verbalize what you know. Hopefully, Robert Carley is a brilliant composer.
Oh, he's amazing.
Completely nailed it. And I think, you know, that I was thinking about it when you talked about tone earlier. There's a way that he has of you know, just slightly cueing the viewing to just a slightly different tone from where we've been before without it getting jaunty or overly ponderous or anything like that. It feels all of a piece, even though it's quite a varied.
I mean, he wrote this score really fast in for this episode, and it's been a real process, organic process for us to find the palette, you know, which is a word we use a lot, and both in that context, but in the context, the visual context, and the context of the characters, what's our palette in this episode, and cool. That sort of stuff.
So let's get back to those writers.
Yep.
So they're sitting in front of you in a cafe or in your office. And you've read their material enough. You've thought enough to sit down and talk to them for 20 minutes.
Well, I guess
What are you looking for?
Well, it depends on where they are in their body of work. You know, I don't want to say career because they're you know, that word makes me scratch a little bit. But from a younger writer, it doesn't happen that often. But I've had interviewed writers who are looking for a job and may have written a pretty good spec and go, you know, I don't watch TV. Really? Yeah. I'm really cinema is my thing. But you know, I understand that there's some good TV being made.
And I really could use just a script to make some
yeah,
money.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, nobody's really that bold, but when I ask, one of the questions I ask everybody is, "What's your favorite TV? What are your favorite TV shows? What do you watch? Mm-hmm. What do you what are you interested in? And they don't have to be the same thing that I'm interested in. It's just, are you interested and can you talk? Like, when you meet somebody for the first time, you need a frame of reference, right? You need a common, like, do we have a similar language when we're talking about story? And so I find it sometimes useful just to say, oh, really? You like Friday Night Lights? Me too. What do you like about it? You know, what did you think of the second season? For fans of Friday Night Lights, that's a controversial season.
Right? They murder at the beginning and all that.
You know, and so I think that I always ask that question. So so I look for people who watch television, and it's hard, particularly if you're working. Mm-hmm. You know, like I haven't seen a lot this year, but you know, just that interest, like the genuine interest in the medium. And so that's sort of the first thing, I think, across the board. I think with senior writers, and when I say senior writers, I don't know if I even include myself in that category, but you know, people who've put in the time on great shows and not so great shows, what are they interested in? Like as people, obviously, I mean, there's, you know, did you watch my show? Did you like it? They don't even have to like it, but did you watch it? People we interviewed for the second season of King who didn't watch the first season, which just was breathtaking to me. What are they interested in as people? And, you know, obviously they can write, you know, if they've been around and have worked, you know, but do their interests, you know, intersect with mine or intersect with where I think the show is going? Are they different enough from mine that they're, and that's really an organic kind of instinctual feel. Like it's not an analytical thing. Like there's no chart to sort of analyze that, but you just kind of go, what are you keen on? What's obsessing you right now? And that's how we started The Room. For this show, which was the first day.
So take us inside that room. Well, I choked to death here.
That's wonderful.
You could use that for a medical.
Yeah,
put it on the list.
Stat.
So take us inside that room. So you've assembled your dream team.
Yeah,
and for the first season, at this point, you'd written one script or two. Yeah.
One. And, okay. Just barely.
Okay. And so what was the process then? How do you get the room going into till it's an entity that's capable of generating episodes?
I keep trying new things because I haven't, you know, it's the third season of television I've been a showrunner on. So, I you know, my answer to the question, I'm just, you know, praising it by saying I'm still figuring it out. I do start, I think, you guys can remind me if I didn't. I do start with what do you like about the show? What do you find is the potential of the show? And what's your personal connection? Like what brings you to this? And I've already asked them that if I've interviewed them, but I want the other writers to hear it. And I find that conversation, when it becomes a little bit personal, when people say, well, you know, my father was a doctor, or this happened, or my, you know, that the other writers absorb it. And one of the other jokes in the room is I'm very uncomfortable with the word theme. And it makes me feel like I'm in a grade 8 English class. And I know I'm supposed
Man's
to think
in of, humanity to
I'm
man.
Supposed to think about it all the time. And I do. It's just the word. It's not that I don't believe, you know, I think every episode needs to be about something. And I think that a good writer writes about something instinctively. And I think some writers are very good at articulating the theme at the beginning of their process. Mm. I'm not one of those writers.
So it's more like you kind of step back at a certain stage and go, what this kind of feels like we're exploring here.
Yeah,
is.
And it's scary and it's messy because you can discover it very late. and you've got a dog's breakfast in front of you, and you're starting to shoot.
Why is it a dog's breakfast if you don't have that, if I may use the word theme?
I think it's coherence. I think it's about the show actually feeling of a piece.
So it's about that. It's once you have a sense of that, you know why something's in an episode and why something shouldn't be in this episode.
It becomes a criterion for editing.
Right.
So this season, having said that, I thought, you know what? I'm gonna use that word. I'm gonna own that word. And I started. And we had a card. It said theme. I was gonna try. You know, because it's a good way of working. But the organic way at it for me is just, what are you interested in? What fascinates you? And themes emerge. Stuff that we were collectively interested in, that collectively, so that we could we were all sort of drawing from the same sort of thematic well, I guess, for the season. And
now is that and then I want to talk a little bit about breaking. We'll sort of just have a few questions about the room before we open it up. But that does that intersect with, I would imagine, with a vast amount of research that has to be done on a show like this? So is that done at an early stage as well, to sort of know in terms of, you know,
we approached research in two ways. One, Carrie Ferenz, we hired to work for, I don't know, a few weeks at least, before the room came together, maybe longer, I can't remember. And her job was just, I gave her categories. I said ER, ICU, infectious disease, which is what Alan's
specialty down, is.
Downstairs right. stories. Yep. And she did an amazing job. We had a document, I think, with 400 cases or something like that. Like, it was insane. It was.
Wow.
Tabbed and categorized and tagged and there was a short description of the case, a longer description of the case, and then there was all of the links and bibliography to all of the information.
So if you were going to take one of these to have all the lingo and
Handed that package to the writers, and so they came in and they had pulled stories that they were interested in. Interestingly, they often, you know, at a certain point in the season, we just went, oh, that story is interesting, and it didn't come from the book at all. Mm. So we had that as a resource, just as a starting point.
And you said there was two types of research for
the other was that. Consultants.
Right.
So we built up over the course of the season a network of people in all of these areas, an ICU nurse, a couple of surgeons.
How do you do
porters.
That? You just pick up the phone or you go get injured and start talking to them.
Yeah.
Hey.
I got really, really sick. I spent a lot of time in the hospital. I started with somebody who I was introduced to, who introduced me to a couple of other people. And Adam Barkin's wife is a OB surgeon, so she introduced us to a couple of people. She helped us out as well. The downstairs people, we found some porters, and Carrie had worked as a PSA. So, and then the character of Bruno, I was introduced to by a doctor, not the character of Bruno, a person whose story informed the creation of Bruno, who was a surgeon in the Philippines and is a file clerk here. And
wow.
So he told me his story.
So much gets told by just that shot of him looking at the wall. It's such a beautiful grace note to that whole story, where he's this wonderful guy for the sick little girl, and then you just realize what it just grabbed. Anyway, that gets
Diego's here tonight, but his episode, which was episode 5 last night, he really nailed it. And we had a very moving moment, I guess, and during the season in episode 8 there's an open heart surgery. I won't tell you how it ends. But we were looking for a heart surgeon to teach us, teach Sarah Canning how to do a purse string suture. And we couldn't find one because they're working. you really want an unemployed heart surgeon to teach you how to do something? So it was, we were searching high and wide for weeks trying to find somebody who could spend the day with us on set, which was a weekday, to supervise that and to help. And at some point, I think Carrie said, why don't we call Herb? And he was the surgeon in the Philippines and is a file clerk here. And sure enough, you know, Herb knew how to do it. So he came to the office one night and sat down in one of our little offices. I think it was one of the writer room's offices. And said, okay, this is how you teach it. There's a styrofoam cup and a banana. And he had he started doing it with the instruments. And the most remarkable thing is that he sent us an email the next day saying he hasn't held those instruments
in
4 years. He wasn't even sure he could do it.
Wow.
And it totally, it was a very emotional email because he hadn't held surgical instruments since he left. And so that, you know, that's sort
the power
of thing.
Of really delving into the truth behind the fiction here and finding real cases and the stories of the people who are working there.
So we
and so then armed with that, as well as this sort of over thematic overview, and I imagine a sense of the character arcs.
Yeah.
When the rubber hits the road and you start breaking episodes, can you talk a bit about how you like to do that with the room?
I like the writers to have carted the show on their own first. So before it's their time up, you know,
So break that down. So before that, you have a sense of the basic storylines.
Right.
They may change, but you have a sense of the storylines, and then the individual writer of that episode will card the show?
Sorry, I did miss a step. The writers will come in and they'll pitch. They'll say, this is the story. Once upon a time, there was whatever. And we have a great time. Just can they tell the story? And
right. And
we go and the other.
That's a skill in itself, isn't it?
It
to
really
be able
is.
To sell a show and also to be able to hear through somebody who's maybe less
exactly.
secure about their storytelling. That actually, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and you don't want to be is there an engine in the episode and what is it offering the show? Is it a great story, but does it belong in this? And one of the things that I do, which I think drives some people crazy. Is after the pitch, or after reading a draft of anything, when we're in the room, I require everybody to say one thing that they love about the script and to articulate one question they have for it. And so if there are eight...
That sounds to me like a theater...
It is. It comes,
rooted.
It comes from a dramaturgical approach.
Yeah,
and
that's... familiar to me.
And doing workshops, some people just don't like it. Like some writers really don't like it. Some producers don't like it. I like it because I like it's nice to hear nice things.
Well, you know, it's also important to know what is working because I don't know about you, but it's very easy to end up jettisoning something in the sort of wild rampage to rethink something that is actually. Good
and somebody
right.
Somebody in the room might see the great potential in a story that I don't.
Right,
and so you go around the room and somebody goes, you know what, I love that Bruno thing, or I love, and you go, oh really? What do you love about it? Oh, it's just, you know what, I've been wanting to see that moment for a long time, and so the writer gets to hear, you know, seven positive pieces of feedback, and I also believe, and this is entirely, you know, one of the prerogatives of the showrunners, I get to impose my process on other people, I guess, I learn as much about how to approach in the next draft from what people are responding positively to as to what they're saying negatively. Mm-hmm. To, you know, I love Griffin, I love what Griffin's doing here, and I go, oh, I'm on the right track there, right? And so everybody, we do that, and then generally we say what's one challenge or what's one question before we launch in. So people pitch, they do that. We'll have a whiteboard, and it'll be fairly free flowing, depending on the writer. Some writers come in with a more structured sort of idea of how the episode's going to go. Other writers are going to come in and pitch a little bit more fluidly, a little bit more instinctively.
And at episode 5, say, are all the writers in the room when this is happening? Or are people
No, we had a really small room on Remedy. Oh, my God. Small but mighty, we called it. So by episode 5, everybody was working, right? And on something. And so I find the middle of part of the season the most challenging as a showrunner. The thing, there's a riddle there that I haven't personally solved. And some of it's just numbers, you know. You know, a script runs into trouble or needs some bench strength, and you take John Callahan, who came in with fresh eyes in the middle of the season, to write episode 7, and we needed some support on one of the scripts. So all of a sudden, you're taking him off of 7, and he's working with the writer with the draft of another episode 4 in that case. But then episode 7 is stopped, right? It's not moving. And so then when he gets back into the room, he's like, where is everybody? And Adam's writing episode 6, and I'm cutting, and Sandra's on set, because I believe writers should be on set as much as possible and in pre-production, and that's maybe something else we could talk about. But so all of a sudden there's no quorum, and there's John, you know, holding his Diet Coke going, Hey guys, episode 7, and you know, people pull you pull people in as much as you can, and it's late in the day or early in the morning, and you know, the team rallies, and he gets one or two people, and he pitches his cards to them and stuff like that. So the middle piece, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Well, let me just. I did want to know whether or not you were able to sort of get that whole room in, which is usually a miracle. So basically, they pitch out their ideas.
Yep.
There's a process of feedback that involves positivity and questions and also some, you know...
And
some hard stuff.
Critical analysis,
they
yeah.
They take that away and they... And once they get a kind of mandate, they take it away
and they, write
and they
a
build the cards.
Well, they'll write a pitch document.
Which goes to the network. After you're ready to do
after
that.
We're ready.
Yeah.
And I did it... Partly it was time, partly because I was trying some different things on this show than I did on... On King, I did a pass on all the pitch documents, especially in the first season. I wanted to make sure they were in my voice, that I could I could defend them. I was a little less hands-on at that point in the process. I think partly because I didn't have the time, partly because the writers were writing good pitch documents, and partly because the network trusted me and us enough as a team that. You know, if
it didn't
it was,
have to be,
it didn't have
perfect
pitch.
Polish,
it didn't have to be
great.
pitch perfect. It was like, this is the show, this is the engine, this is the game we're hunting.
Yeah,
are
you
guys
can
on?
Fall down that rabbit hole where it becomes a great deal of time to craft that one page.
They're really hard. Yeah. Oh my God, pitch pages are just brutal to write.
So once you've got one and you've had feedback, and this is the first time generally, unless I imagine there's a big thing, that the network weighs in.
Yes.
And once you've had a discussion around that and got feedback, then they go ahead and
Then we'll say, and everybody does it differently. Like my version of it, as I said before, is my big black book with no lines and a bunch of bubbles, and then I color into the lines. It's weird. You've seen it. And eventually I forced to put them on cards. But, you know, other writers go right to the board and, you know, axe across the side, beats along down the bottom, and they color code their cards for the storylines. But I just want them to throw something up. It's like a beat sheet, really. Mm-hmm. Just throw something. Give us some clay to work with.
But this is a visual. Generally,
it's a visual
a column
thing.
Per act.
Yeah.
And so then once they've done that, do they sort of present?
Yeah.
And
they pitch them.
You can sort of see it.
Just tell me the story.
Yeah.
You know, and that's very telling. Partly it's the actor background, but it's interesting if somebody can actually tell the story. Mm-hmm. If they can actually carry you through the story, and if they can. That's telling you something about the story's got legs, right? Mm-hmm. And if they can't, or if they're going, and then she runs down the hall, and then and like then you know it doesn't mean the story's bad. It just means you can start seeing where the gaps are,
right? But do you find there's certain writers who are just I found this especially working in the States, they could sell me on anything.
Yeah,
they
well, that sounds the danger,
so
isn't it?
Good.
That is
right?
the danger.
And you're like, oh my God, this is great. But it, and then there'll be people who don't have that confidence. That where I'm they're sort of running away from their own story. I'm like, no, this is working. This is good.
Which is it's absolutely damn. I did it to myself in the second episode. I sold myself and the room and the network on an A story that did not work.
And when did you realize that it didn't work?
Way too late.
But at least you had the courage
Holy
to realize it.
How? I hope I actually get to use this story. It was, you know, we were looking for something to link everybody together in the second episode, and I hadn't gotten to it, right? And, you know, I was getting the show up, and I was like, oh my God, I have to write it. And then, the original plan was that the second episode, I think, was going to shoot second, right? And then it ended up shooting first. So I lost 2 weeks. Precious 2 weeks.
Overnight, it needed to be the first one to prep. And
so I pitched this story of social. We'd found these stories of people using text and social media in hospitals, people who work there, and violating people's privacy. So an innocent selfie with the picture of a wounded person in the background, and posted on Facebook becomes an issue. Nurses sharing, like doctors sharing a photograph of a medical mystery, sending it across the country. Well, they've been sued by the patient for sharing confidential information across an. So that this was kind of interesting. So I thought that would be really cool. Let's get I'm saying this publicly so I never forget. Soon as the pitch starts with, okay, there's a celebrity in the hospital, run away. And I did it, you know, because first of all, unless you get a real celebrity, nobody's buying it. And second of all, so we thought a celebrity gets a picture taken of them, and the mystery is who took it. The doctors think it was the nurses think it was the porters think it was the PSAs and somebody. And so we thought this would be a kind of a good runner, a good framing device. For the episode, or I thought that. And the writers all went, you're the boss, sure.
Well, and they're just started, right? So yeah. Nobody's going to stick their neck out.
Although this room was pretty good. I'd worked with Sandra before. She's pretty vocal. We had strong personalities in that room. And I didn't get away with anything. But we all thought it sounded good.
Yeah.
And pretty good. And the network is like, fantastic, an upstairs downstairs story, it connects everybody, let's do that. And then I went away to sort of beat it out, and I went, oh my God, there's no engine here. I couldn't find an engine for it. I mean, I'm sure one of you guys could write.
There's a catalyst.
There's a catalyst, there's an inciting really incident, and there's a kind of a mystery, but where it was going to land structurally in the show wasn't going to be the focus of the show. So I couldn't solve it. I'm sure one of you guys could solve it, but I couldn't
this
solve
it. This room right now, this thing
there
is going
go.
To turn into...
We're just
going to
bring up the cards now. But I couldn't solve it. I don't know why. Just my imagination didn't move in that direction, but I sold everybody on it.
And so... So you were selling them. You were a good pitcher in that case. You were able to sort of take them through your cards. Everybody was feeling the magic. You went away to work on it, and that's when
I ran aground and I had to come back into the room and go, you know what? I think I have to toss my own idea. I think it sucks. And then it's okay. So help me. Give me another idea, quick.
Well, and so what happens? Just take me through the rest of this process, and then we'll open it up for a few quick questions. So what would happen generally is they would, right or wrong, they get their marching orders.
Yeah.
They start writing an outline.
Yeah.
And then that's brought back to the whole room.
Yeah. Our outlines, I'm not super popular with some writers. I write like really detailed outlines, and I like really, really detailed. Like we're talking 24 to 33 page outlines on an hour long show. And I want to know the movie I'm going to be watching, the movie that I'm going to be making before I send it to draft. And I want the network to know.
Totally.
I think that part of it is the way my brain works. I just want to see the connective tissue. I want to see what the engine is. I want to have some sense of what it's about. So that's just a sort of personal taste thing. But also, I've come to believe, I think, at least with the people we're working with at Shaw and I worked with on King, is they know what show they're getting.
Right.
They know the episode.
By the time they get that outline.
By the time they get that outline. And if they're going to call us back on something, they're going to call us back then.
Yes.
They're not going to call us back on the second draft, which has happened on other shows, where they have a different process. It's not as in depth in the outline, so they get to draft sooner, which is great for production. There are all sorts of downsides to these detailed outlines, but they get to production, and then the network goes, "Oh, this is what this thing is about," and if.
Right. In the shorthand, you had one thought bubble, and the network had another thought bubble, and then all of a sudden
they're going, no, this isn't what we thought it was, and it's their money, right? I'm a steward of their money, and we have good creative collaboration. And I'm not conflict averse, but in the end.
It's their show.
It's their show. Yeah. They're the stakeholders.
So sometimes that's a couple drafts then of maybe not always straight to draft after the network. Feedback. They may want
to
see.
We'll go back to outline. We'll stay in outline for sometimes too long, to be frank. And Bernie Zuckerman, in terms of our collaboration, weighs in very heavily at that point. And Bernie, he's been in the business a long time. We have actually very different tastes in a lot of ways. But you ignore somebody who's worked for 40 years telling stories at your peril.
At your peril. Yeah.
You really do.
One last question before we open it up to other questions. Once you've done the writer's done a couple drafts, how much? And I sort of know the answer to this, but I'm interested in this. Isn't that what you're never supposed to ask a question?
No, answer it too, because I want to see if it's the same one.
rewriting. How much do you rewrite? Doing the final polish, and how's that attitude changed for you over the years as a showrunner?
Well, that's in flux. So I did a massive amount of rewriting on King. Not because the scripts were bad. They weren't, I don't think. But I just wanted my hands in it. And so I did big rewrites on pretty much all those scripts in both seasons, I think. There's two that I think, David, that I didn't really... pretty heavy. Not like changing the story and stuff, but that show was tricky because the lead character of King, I felt like I was the only one who could get that voice, and because it was a single lead show, she was in almost every scene. I felt compelled to rewrite.
So you had a different approach.
Because I did the show running job, the producing job from, during the day, and then I would rewrite at night. And so I was getting like 3 or 4 hours sleep a night, really, like honestly. And so I knew I couldn't sustain that again. I did it for 2 years and for better and for worse. So I made a decision this year to try and rewrite less. I think I succeeded. I think my hands are on most of the scripts at some point to heavier or lighter degrees. I think it helped that this was an ensemble show, and so there was a diversity of voices, and there was there was room for a more sort of varied sort of writer voice thing. I know, and I gather this notion of writer's voice is a little bit controversial in television. Some people believe in it and other people don't. I don't know where I land. I think I'm trying to loosen my grip a little, both because it's just so much more work. And I'm not talking about a polish. I'm not talking about a dialogue polish. I'm talking about like getting
you
in crack, there.
You were cracking it.
I was cracking. Yeah, restructuring it, yeah. Scenes, not so much.
Yeah. So an ideal dream script when you get it. It's what, a couple hours, 4 hours on a Saturday, 4 hours on a Sunday, and you're done kind of thing? Or do you generally?
I write slow, so it's probably longer than that. But yeah, I mean, an ideal script for me, when the draft gets to the place where we all believe in it, it doesn't require restructuring. And I think this season, most of the rewrites that I did were in an effort to deepen what was there in my own way, mm-hmm. From my own understanding.
So it was about building on what was there.
Yeah, or simply going, oh, I know what you mean, and I think if we took it in this direction, we might achieve something. Mm-hmm. And
I'm going to leave it at that,
yeah,
because please. I should open this up to some questions. We've got 3 more hours to go, and then we'll beat the Tom Fontana record. So just hope you brought water. No, we're supposed to be wrapping up now, but this conversation was just too good to stop. So anyway, if you have any questions, there's some microphones on either side, and just put your hand up and ask them, and Greg will answer them. That's how it works.
Or not.
I was just curious to know, when you were staffing some of the lower level writers, what are some of the specs, like the shows for existing shows that you were reading? And also, what are some of the stuff that you did when you were starting out?
I started out in a very peculiar way. So the specs that I don't have specs that I ask for or look. I mean, there are trends, I guess. Like Good Wife was a spec that a lot of people. The positive side of a show that's spec'd a lot is that you know how to read it, how to analyze it. You can compare people's execution of House. You get 3 different spec houses. You go, oh wow, that person's got that voice. That person's got the structures, that sort of thing. So I think try and spec a show that's on TV. But that's not always easy. Shows get canceled. Spec a show that plays to your strengths, I think, is really important. It's one thing to go, I love that show. I'd love to write that show. But if that's not what you do or what you do well, if you do character and voice well, then don't go after a complex structural experiment of a show, what I did, because I felt that the reason I guess I'm saying that is what I felt my strength was character and voice. So my first and only spec, to be honest, was an episode of Entourage, and I thought, okay, I can give funny, and I got those guys' voices, and I wrote that, and but I don't know if that actually helped me, because I had original pilot, but the way I got my start was very different, so.
And, do you also find when it's like a 70-page spec that it's like the bottom of the pile?
No, because my scripts are 70 pages.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I always feel like, oh, God, if you're going to write a spec, like 50
Damn
pages
it.
Will tell me your voice. And when you're thinking about somebody who's reading so many scripts that, I can see how this, it's like a, it's almost like Flashpoint, and it's pacing and
yeah,
dialogue.
This was a 68-page script.
Yeah, I was just fine whenever it's a spec script. I think, oh, just show me some mercy.
No, it's true. I mean, the truth is that you can tell a couple acts in whether the person is of interest to you.
Yeah.
And I say that very specifically, as opposed to this person is a good writer or a bad writer, because people, A, mature at different times. They're hitting me at a certain time in terms of what my interest is in. So it's really, am I interested in this material? Am I interested in this person right now? Not, are they good?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Which I think is an important thing to remember, that it's not a judgment necessarily
on
you. It's what Greg is looking for in that alchemy of a room, and what he's trying to balance in terms of ability and skill. Okay, we've got, you got a laser shine there.
Wow.
Hey.
I wanted to ask, as a showrunner, what do you do to make sure that your writer's room is a good, happy environment? And is it?
Not all the time. I wish I knew how to answer that question. I try. I try to treat people with respect. I try to create an environment. What I was saying earlier, I make sure that everybody says something positive and constructive. Everything's constructive, but positive, what they like about it. I try to encourage people to frame their criticisms as questions without being pedantic about it, although I do get pedantic. And because I just think it's more constructive. But you end up in disagreements. You end up in taste things. And what's interesting is the thing that I most want to engender as a showrunner is a sense of ownership from my collaborators over their stuff. Whether they're writers or editors or whatever, I want them to believe in what they've done. But there are times where you hit this moment where you go, I'm so glad you believe in that. I don't. And that's a very difficult moment because sometimes the writer can feel betrayed because I've asked them to invest in this story. They've invested in it, time. They've invested emotionally in it. And then part of my job is to go, is that my show? Is that our show, really? And it's a subjective call. And if I've succeeded in creating this environment of ownership, and then I say, great, I'm glad you own it, I'm glad you believe in it, but it doesn't belong, it can create conflict that can be uncomfortable. And navigating that, I think, is a real challenge. I think we've talked about this. I want to take a negotiation and mediation course. I actually think the Writers Guild should sponsor them. And I don't mean that facetiously. I think that other industries have, for people who find themselves in leadership positions, have an infrastructure to teach them communication skills. And I think I've got pretty good communication skills. We've talked about this. But I think you get, you know, fatigue and stress compromise your ability to communicate. And people who've, you know, there's lots of thinking and studying in how to lead and how to communicate in high-pressure, project-based environments. And I think by virtue of where we are in our development as an industry, where showrunning and the word showrunner is fairly new in Canada, relatively speaking, a lot of us are landing in this chair with a bunch of experience, but not necessarily leadership experience where 120 people are working for you at the height of a show, working with you, not for you. And you hit a crisis, a human resource crisis or something like that. That's part of being a showrunner. And you do your best. And I've got Bernie on one side. You know, King, I had David Barlow. I was smart enough, so I had a Senate. I had these two very experienced people I could turn to. But I do think that there's a skill set as a showrunner and in a writer's room, whether you're the showrunner or not, about communication and problem solving and conflict resolution and stuff like that. And I think about those things. I don't know if I do them particularly well, but I think about them. So I try and create a positive environment. But sometimes things happen. Sometimes it's stress too. You know, you're just short. You're tired and you're short.
Hi there. I was curious to know, you guys have been doing a lot of social media live tweeting with the cast and everybody, and I was curious if that has changed your perception on what you would do for the next season, and if the broadcasters are taking that into consideration, because I know you guys were trending last night. Do you think that would be more of an influence for them to bring you up for the next season? Any comments on that?
That's a good... I'm new to that game, the social media game, so I'm just sort of throwing... I think I must be the worst Twitter person ever, although I try, because I don't know the rules. I do think that Twitter is a metric that broadcasters look at now. And I think that in social media generally. And so they track it. And there are people, you know, we hire to manage it.
As of this year, it's actually part of the ratings system.
Right. Oh, it is.
They include Twitter in the ratings.
Well, we trended last night, apparently.
Fucking A.
But I think there is a question about what does it mean? Like, does it just mean that the most vocal people are Twittering and it's actually not a super successful show? But a lot of people who, you know, that particular audience is socially media, savvy social media. They live on that. You know, like King, you know, the people that it appealed to, I think, were older, generally speaking. So there was, like, nothing happening on Twitter, right? Like, it was just like, you go there, it's just depressing. There's only one person watching. And really, at a certain point, there probably was only one person watching. But
does it now affect how you think about storytelling in the future?
No, it doesn't. I think madness that way lies. I do. I'm really enjoying my interaction with people online. I spend a lot of time on my line during show apologizing to nurses and doctors who are appalled at some of the things that we've done. But I actually enjoy that too. I enjoy being able to, you know, send somebody going, I like, there's just an egregious error in the pilot, right? Sandy takes blood from a shoulder. I have no idea how that happened. It's like, it's so embarrassing. And I got letters every day for the week after the pilot, like letters, emails sent to Indian Grove, tweets, I'm never watching this show again. How disrespectful. What are you doing? Do you have any consultants? I wrote them all back, apologizing and saying, yep, egregious error. So it's, but I'm too new to it to know how much it's going to influence. I'm certainly interested when I go on, I see, you know, people are like shipping. This is a new word for me. I learned it earlier this year. So Ziff is Zoe and Griff. So I'm interested in that, what relationships people are invested in. I think it's really cool, and I do listen to that, and I go, wow, they're invested in this. In this season, Sandy and Brian is a very curious thing, seeing what people, nobody's, funnily enough, they're the ones engaged, and nobody's shipping them, which I don't mind.
I had to look it up the first time on Bomb Girls. I didn't know. I had to go to urbandictionary.com and look it up. We've got a question at the back there.
Hi. Oh. I'm over here.
Oh, hi.
sounds like really echoey.
Oh, hi.
Hi. You said really early on that you found that there was a freedom in the structure of the hospital. And I was wondering if you could talk about how there's, even for Remedy or even for King, how you still find like life and inventiveness inside of a procedural format.
What I mean by liking genre work and the rules is I know the rules. I don't have to invent them, right? So obviously sports analogies are, you know, like it's hockey. You know what an offside is. You know what the size of the rink is. You know what the audience's expectations are. You know that they expect a certain thing at the end of an act. They expect something in the fourth act. There's certain sort of tropes. You know, I use the word trope instead of cliche. Handled badly, it's a cliche. Handled well, it's a trope. It's a thing. And so it's interesting. It's like, or music, like a three-bar blues or something. You go, that's just not changing, but how many variations can you find? And because my mind is not trying to reinvent the wheel structurally, my mind, the mind of the writers, is dedicated to, okay, well, now what interesting story can we tell inside this structure, and does this story fulfill this structure? And if it doesn't, it's not our show, because the audience doesn't, you know, the audience is expecting, you know, some running and jumping or whatever it is. And there's no running and jumping in this. And then we have to go, okay, well, are we going to break the convention and there's no running and jumping? We're not pulling out a gun, or but we know we're breaking the rule. So I just like those parameters, and I find it just frees my mind up a little bit just to focus on the what I hope, anyway, is the humanity of the characters or the entertainment value of the story.
Great. We have time for two more questions, unless this last question is really a bad question, in which case it'll be the last question. No pressure.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Greg. Hi. I mean, first off, thank you for being here. It's really great talk.
Thank you.
Like, it's very interesting to me because you started working in the industry as an actor, and then, so after years, then you switch your gear and working, you know, behind the camera. So, you know, it's like, I wonder how that happened, and is it a career switching, or like how could you do that from on camera to behind?
I don't know how it happened. It was when I was an actor. I don't think I'm not an actor now. I just sort of don't act. But when I was an actor, I did a lot of work with new Canadian playwrights. We never worked together when you were a playwright, but my wife.
With your wife.
Yeah. So I was always around new writing, and I think at a certain point I kind of woke up to the fact that I was interested in writing as much or more as I was interested in being on stage. I wanted to direct a short film. I decided years ago in my early 30s, and so. I was working as an actor at the Shaw Festival, and there was a writer who was married to an actor, Catherine Schlemmer, and so I knocked on her door. I said, why don't we write a short film together? So I can direct it, or why don't you write a short film? And so she did, and it's called Learning to Swim, and I directed it, and that was 1997. So that was sort of my first thing, and then I wanted to direct again, so I had a friend. I wrote with a partner for 10 or 12 years, Peter Smith, who's a really fine writer and a great person. And so I called him at the beginning and I said, he had written these stories about growing up in Barrie in the 60s called Barrie Tales. I said, let's turn one of those into a short film. And so we did, and then we took another one and did it, and then we gave them to Ray Story, who's showrunner of Wind at My Back at the time, and a playwright. And we had knew him, so we called in the favor and said, can you read these? And he said, this would make a great television show. And people wanted to work with Ray. They didn't know who we were, but they wanted to work with Ray. So Ray went to, we had an agent the next day. And a week later, 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, I guess we had a development deal at CBC. And so I kind of fell backwards into it. I kept acting for a while, but the writing just, there was more and more, that show we developed for 6 years and never got made. But we got paid.
So from 6 years to 10 months.
No, it's just insane.
You paid your dues.
So I guess I fell backwards into it. And at a certain point, I just decided, or momentum or something, I just decided that this is what I wanted to do. I like imagining worlds, and I like participating in all elements of production. And as an actor, you're often very limited. You're told to just do your one thing, and I like the bigger picture. So I think that's what drew me to it. I wish there was a more sort of cathartic moment I could share, but it was a slower transition for me. And I was very grateful for mentorship. Ray Story was a great early mentor for both Peter and I, and Bernie's been a great mentor, and I can't overstate how important it is to find those people who are experienced and will help you. Ray. What we'd never written television. Ray went, that's a good television show. You should do that. And taught us a tremendous amount. So, anyway.
Thank you. That was a great question. So we're going to have another one. The last question goes to...
Hi. I'm curious, given you said you were ordered straight to series from just the pilot, and how serial the nature of the stories are with all the characters, how much did the pilot itself change after you were breaking the story within the room, if any at all?
I didn't break the story in the room. The pilot I worked on with Bernie.
I think the question was, once you started breaking the subsequent episodes,
right,
did you go back and find yourself revising the first hour?
I don't remember. Did I, guys? No, I don't think it changed at all.
Make it work.
I'll tell you what did change. And I mentioned this a little bit earlier about Kelly Macon, who directed it. The original pilot had that mannequin scene that I talked to, that Alan showered with the mannequins. I think that was pretty much the only thing we cut, right? And but it didn't have that opening sequence. The original pilot up until like days before we started shooting, I think, started in the ambulance. And I liked that. And I wanted that to be the beginning. And Kelly really advocated for a visual cinematic opening. He didn't tell me what it should be. He didn't say that's what it should be, but he said it. You need and I went kicking and screaming into that sequence. I wrote it. I wrote it, you know, line for line. But I like the show starting. You know, I'm a writer. I like how it started. You know, this is what it got us this far, and I'm so grateful he kept pushing. Because I love that opening. I think it's an exceptional opening. I think the execution of it is really beautiful, and I think it grabs the audience, and it's its own little overture. And what was the question? Oh my God, I got totally lost.
You were saying that's really the
damn it.
That's the one area. That's
going to try not.
You were holding it together for so long. That vodka bottle's empty.
Oh jeez.
You were saying that that's the one thing that you can think of.
Yeah.
The
other thing that changed in the pilot, again, and it's thanks to Kelly and to Network Notes, was I tend to like, you know, like my taste when I'm writing is that scenes go like fast, one into the other, one into the other, one into the other. And Kelly was really encouraging me to land, like in the writing, just land on somebody. Don't land on dialogue. Just land on an image, land on a face, and he would say, let me take care of that. And if you don't like it, we can go dialogue to dialogue to dialogue the way that, you know, the draft was written. And again, I'm very grateful for that. I learned something. I do feel, because I spend a lot of time in the editing room, Lisa, one of our editors, is here, a brilliant editor, edited the pilot. I wonder, you know, later in the season, I wonder whether I was doing it too much, because I fell in love with that idea. But so the writing didn't change. I was very, and King, I don't think a word changed either. Like, we were very lucky. The network bought that pilot. They said they liked that pilot. It's not flawless. It's got lots of problems. But the people that I've been working with on these two shows recognized whatever the merits of the show were and kind of went, okay, we'll just let that one stand. They, you know, they had thoughts, and we developed, you know, they noted me draft to draft. But once we had that draft, everybody respected it. And if they didn't, you know, I have Bernie, and Bernie would have stood in front of the train and stopped it. He would have said,
yeah, I mean, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about Bernie and his work and the amazing partnership that you guys have together, and also the role that Kelly Macon, who is a co-executive producer on the series, as well as the first director, brilliant director, and his evident contribution to the show as well. And it's interesting that seems to be where more of the learning curve came about, was when you brought the director into the picture, rather than a sort of retrospective thing once you kept working on subsequent scripts.
Yeah, Kelly's a visual stylist, you know, and he directed the first two episodes, and he trusted first thing about Kelly is he trusted the script. Like, he didn't mess with it. Like, he didn't come in but what he did do was say, okay, now my job is to visualize this thing, and I need your help. And the opening is a great example, because I didn't want to do it. Anybody in the writer's room knows I did not want to do it.
Well, his instincts were right.
Absolutely. He was dead on.
Yeah.
He was dead on. And it's a really strong, I think it's a really strong opening.
Well, so we end where we began at the beginning of the episode.
Oh, that's so nice.
That's May, long may it run. It's
what
a fantastic series.
Of this conversation?
I have no idea. We'll leave that for them to discuss afterwards. Thank you guys so much. It's a wonderful evening. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Indian Grove Productions and also Shaw Media. And also, of course, Greg Spottiswood for his generous time this evening. Thank you, Greg.
Michael.
That wraps up today's interview. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please log on to iTunes and leave us positive feedback, as we're always looking to increase our show's profile. Also, feel free to retweet the podcast link. We'd love to hear from you, and you can email us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. Special thanks to Tiff Bell Lightbox, Indian Grove Productions, and Shaw Media. This podcast is sponsored by the Writers Guild of Canada. The show's technical producer is Philip Vukievich. I'm Michael McLennan. Thanks for listening.